This show is sponsored by Qualitest. Deploy software that you and your customers trust with Qualitest Testing and Business Assurance Services. Learn more about Qualitest at qualitestgroup.com.
Hello and welcome to The Testing Show. Believe it or not, we're here live. Well, we're recording it live, I guess. From Orcas Island at the Reinventing Testers training run by Satisfice. Lead instructor of James Bach.
Hello.
Welcome to the show, James. If you don't know James, you probably should.
You live under a rock.
Right. James is a creator, co-creator of the Rapid Software Testing course and method. Co-author of Lessons Learned in Software Testing. Co-author of the Context-Driven Manifesto. And co-founder of the Association for Software Testing. Is that...
Well, that sounds good. Yeah. Okay. What can I do for you?
We're going to talk about reinventing testers, I would think. We've also got Justin Werman, as always.
Hi.
Welcome back, Justin, and Perse Ababa.
Hello.
So believe it or not, the three of us, I wish Michael was here, just all went to the same training, and James is here, so like we cut out of lunch early. What should our audience know about testers? And I would say maybe two or three things. These keep coming up on the show. Is the testing profession in need of change, and what do we think that might look like?
Well, yeah, the testing profession is kind of like Europe in the 1600s. It's fragmented. It's full of overlapping cultures, and it's being attacked in different ways from different sides on different grounds. It's hard to give a quick answer, but I'm going to try to give a quick answer. The agilists who are into collaboration as the core value of everything, they criticize the very concept of having a testing role as being somehow inherently divisive. And they think divisiveness is the worst thing in the world. I think shipping a product with really bad bugs is the worst thing in the world, not divisiveness. But then I'm a very divisive person. So I live my life with constant divisiveness. I bring it everywhere I go. That's just my experience. So I have a different relationship to divisiveness than a lot of people do.
Allow me to ask you a question about these collaboration people.
Yeah, right. Sure.
Of which you might argue, sometimes I'm kind of one of them. Sometimes I'm not. Would you agree, in the bad old days, in the 80s, where we had these huge walls between dev and test, and we had phases... We're in the coding phase, so you can come back later, tester. And we would hand a spec under the wall, and we would say, here, tester, go test this. You don't need to talk to a customer. You don't need to talk to a programmer. Just test the software. We had to develop a variety of skills, which we gave fancy names to, like equivalence class partitioning, or boundary value analysis, or decision trees. We had to develop all these different techniques to attack the software. Some of the collaborationist agile testers have this insight, which I think was a good one. Hey man, what if we just like got everybody together and did a broad census of risk and just talked about what the heck we were building and tried to build a shared mental model of what we were building, and then just kind of, and this is where I disagree with them, we'll just kind of sort of play with it, we'll come up with some examples, and that simple change in behavior will radically improve the quality of the software.
I think that's true if you're a group of really shallow people. I think that is really true. My problem is that I took a lot of management training around those times, and I would be in rooms with people who, for instance, I took a class on managing by consensus. And one of the exercises was your little group has to come to consensus on this little toy problem. My group decided that since it was too hard to convince me that they were right, they would just ignore me and declare that they had come to a consensus, which is, by definition, a fail.
Right.
The way they decided to do it is they just said, well, we don't recognize this guy as actually part of our community.
He's not playing fair.
It's too hard to come to a consensus, so instead of changing our minds or accommodating him in any way, we're just going to kick him out. So to me, I said, great, you just auto-failed. This whole process was, we have to come to consensus.
Did you genuinely disagree with them, or were you partially messing around?
I don't think it's messing around to explore and learn. Okay. And I was exploring and learning. If I'm in an office setting, I might, and with people that I have to work with and live with day to day, I am much more accommodating because you mess up your relationship and it's bad trouble for a long time. I depend upon these people. I can't just push my best idea and push them too hard and not consider their feelings.
But you had your best idea, you weren't convinced.
I thought, you know, I think it's hard to manage by consensus, and I'm going to demonstrate it's hard by taking a position which, although it was principled, and truth, this was my opinion that I was sharing, it was a matter of ranking a bunch of items on a list. And it was a bunch of items that NASA says you might take to the moon, and what are the most important things that NASA says you should take to the moon, or something like that. It was a toy kind of problem. Mm-hmm. And I said, this is what I think. They said, this is what we think. And I'm like, I disagree with you because of this. And they're like, we don't want to argue with you. Now, they might have argued with me a little bit, but then when I wasn't agreeing with them, they were like, oh, whatever. Consensus has been reached by throwing this guy out. And to me, that was very useful education. What I learned from that is that when people say, it's just easy, just get together and collaborate, what always goes with that is, oh, and if anyone's hard to work with, we just won't have them on our team. Good luck. That's what I mean when I say if you're just a bunch of shallow people, that's one thing. But if you have a group of deep thinkers, what are the chances that they're all going to come at the same thing from the same angle and not have to have big conversations? Well, I already know what the chances are because I had a 15-year collaboration with Kem Kaner, which involved many multi-hour discussions to work through our differences because both of us wanted to get it right. And I worked with Brian Merrick. I've done this with you, Matt. We have had disagreements, and then we called each other up, and we had to go through 30 minutes or whatever of, this is what I meant, oh, it's not what you said, and, you know, we go back and forth like that, right?
Yeah.
One thing that we certainly have learned is that, oh, that must have happened 5-6 times so far, where I know I've been angry. I don't know if you're angry. I can't tell if you're angry. But I know I've been angry, and we've had a conversation, and it gets worked out. But from the outside, that might be like, see, collaborate. But from the inside, I know those were not easy conversations for you. Mm. I know that you had to behave in a rather heroic way in order to do that. You had to do some interesting tricks with your pride. And maybe I had to do some interesting tricks with my pride so that I would even want to talk to you at all. And there have been times where you said, let's talk. Let's call each other on voice right now. And I've said, I don't want to go voice. I'm too angry.
Because I'm angry. Usually,
I'm angry.
Usually I can tell.
And I just yell at you.
I'm angry
just gonna yell at you.
That's usually what he says.
So I don't feel like yelling at you right now. At least one conversation I've postponed because I've said I don't feel like yelling at you right now. So as a difficult person, I know I'm a difficult person to work with, but part of why I'm a difficult person is I actually do honestly care about quality, and the quality of my work and the quality of other people's work, and it really bugs me when other people's bad work makes me look bad. This matters to me, and I think anyone who's a craftsman, this matters to them too. And I think it's worth having these conversations and working through it. But it's so difficult to do depending on who it is that you are dealing with. So for people just to say, everyone just get together and collaborate, like everybody is equally easy to work with and we're all whatever, you know, let's just do what you want this time. You know, I do that in my marriage, but I need to stay married. You know, I do often compromise on the quality of ideas in my marriage because my spouse's feelings, no matter how I think about them rationally, I must accept and I must deal with that. So I'll do that with her. But professionally, quality of work is more important to me than somebody's feelings.
And I've read that in articles before, recommendations. This 37 Signals guy, I think, actually recommends you say, I'm going to give you this one. And there's a reciprocity there. And then when I feel really strongly, I've never really quite seen that work the way he explained it.
I do think that's a good idea.
It's nice.
I think I've had that happen to me, and it has worked on me. And I've done it with other people.
I don't do it explicitly. I do it tactfully. My default response is to give people one. And then if that's all that's ever happening, I say, what's up with that?
So the Zappos, the people that are trying to exercise the Reinventing Organizations book, completely flattened their organization and removed all titles, except for the titles that are documented in a piece of software to help them find each other. But when people disagree, they have these almost cult-like meetings called coming to agreement meetings, which produce basically the same results you just described. They argue, and then in the end, they write something down that may or may not have been the discussion they actually had.
So, you see, I don't mind that kind of idea of let's just throw this away, as long as there's this element to that. And I don't know if they have. I doubt they do have this.
I think the pendulum is swinging away. I think they're finding that that did not work at all for them.
Yeah. What I look for, just the difference between cult-like and reasonable to me is when you say, oh, we're going to use this method, we're just going to work things out, and we recognize that it might be too hard to do that. And when it's too hard to do that, we have a protocol for that. We have an understanding for that. And while it may be too hard to do that, and while we may have to use our escalation protocol, we recognize that we value people, even if they might be uncomfortable with this process, we value being flexible about the process to accommodate people who work in a little different way. As an example, Johanna Rothman, an argument with her once about exit criteria. I don't use exit criteria. I think it's a silly idea.
Exit criteria meaning these are the things we need to release a product?
Yeah, we have to achieve all this stuff and then we can release the product. And I have never used exit criteria. That's not quite true. I shy away from using defined exit criteria figured out way in advance. Johanna Rothman, I said, well, we just discuss it. We just discuss it and we solve the problem. Johanna told me once, well, that privileges people who are good at discussing things under pressure and having arguments, and they have golden rhetoric, like you, James. Huh, isn't that interesting? You actually enjoy having arguments, and you're advocating for a management system that involves arguing. But what you're doing is you are hurting people who are introverted and don't want to have these arguments. They don't want to have social confrontations. And the exit criteria is something that helps them.
People, right?
Right. So what she opened my eyes to is if I care, if I decide that I care about everyone that we have hired and we say you're part of our team, if I decide that I care about them, then I must adapt to them to some degree and not just expect them to adapt to me or to adapt to the protocol that I defined, the Peregrine paradigm or the EST principle or whatever the fancy method is by which we're going to come to agreement. Personally, I just think humans have to be in charge. That's one thing. Not the method, but the humans. Because whenever a method's in charge, it means there is a human in charge who is hiding like a bridge troll under the method but doesn't want to confront you.
Have you studied the core protocols? Check-in is a protocol in this list of protocols that are rules about communicating.
Core protocol? And, I don't know anything
like
about
them.
You can Google it. It's Jim McCarthy's method. From what I understand, people that are very, very good at the core protocols are able to kind of verbally bully. Right, like, now's not the time for that, or that was not communicated the right way, or it's actually
said. I'm very sensitive to that because I am victimized by that, or I don't feel victimized because I never feel like a victim. I feel like this happens to me, I punch back. So I'm an actor, I'm responsible for myself. If I don't like a situation, I leave the situation. And if I don't leave the situation, it's my own damn fault. That's how I've constructed my life so that I never have to feel like a victim. Is either my fault or else I change it. But I have been in a situation where someone makes rules and I feel like these rules don't work for me. What I do is I just go above the rules. I just go offline, talk to the facilitator and say, I'm trying to have a meeting here. I feel like the rules are actually stopping us from doing that. There's a thing in the peer conference concept that I'm involved with that I disagree with, called red cards. If you heard of K card, you know all about
K
cards,
sure.
Right? Maybe I'm actually talking to your listeners.
Have
you heard of K cards? What you should say is, I have, James, but just refresh
just
my memory.
Just for the audience.
Yeah. Imagine that you're controlling a conversation among a lot of people by giving everyone a set of colored cards, and green means I have a new thing I want to talk about, and yellow means I want to say something about that thing that other guy's talking about. And the red card is, I've got something very urgent to say. And I hate it when they're introducing these and the facilitator says, now the red card is only for very urgent things. And if you use the red card in the wrong situation, I will take it away from you. Because I always say, then I'll just speak without a red card. So you're not silencing me by taking the red card out. Let's just,
I'll just interrupt.
Be clear about this.
I'll just interrupt.
I'm just going to interrupt. Because I'm still a human and you can't take my humanity away from me. And you don't take my social standing away from me. When you take damn red card away, I actually think we don't need a red card. I think we could just say there's green, there's yellow, and if there's something really urgent that you want to say, just say it. But please, if it isn't really urgent, could you use the green and the yellow thing? It would really help us. But of course, you know, be a reasonable adult, and if you want to respond to something that someone has just accused you of or whatever, just go ahead and respond. And you know what? I, as a facilitator, I can handle that. If I need you to be quiet, I'm not going to take away your red card. That's like saying process rules you. No, it's about people. If I want to get you to stop talking all the time, I won't take away your red card. I'll just take you offline and say, what can I do to make this work better for you, man? Because this is pretty disruptive, I feel.
Yeah.
So what can I do to make this better? And then we'll just work it out like adults. So whenever I see these protocols, I want to know that there is a meta protocol. And one of my mentors years ago on process said, if you ever make a rule for something, you should also make a rule for suspending the rule. There should always be a clearly understood method of suspending the rule that you just put into place. I think that's very good advice, and yet we don't see that a lot.
So we got to get back to the training. Before we go, I wanted to sort of close the circle. I had said this collaboration-y stuff, they say, maybe if we that's going to be so much better than if we slide the specs under the wall.
And I said it's not that easy.
We don't pay attention to the classic test techniques. I would say...
Now, that's where you went a left turn into another dimension.
I don't agree with that either.
I have no idea what you're talking about. How can collaboration mean that you don't need test techniques?
Yeah,
what's the logic connection to that?
I am not making that claim. It is an observation I have had of certain people in certain communities, and I have asked them about it, and they said, you got a point there.
Meaning that if you have people in a room, you don't actually need to study testing the work just
That seems to be the way they are behaving.
Right.
And when I've asked, because I would say, have the power of two, do both, right? But when I ask them about that, they say out loud, I've never studied testing formally, some of these folks, and we seem to be getting away with it because just having executable specifications, when you do this and do that, you should expect to see this, combined with playing with it.
There's all kinds of issues.
Oh, and by the way, our customers don't actually pay for the product.
Well, even real software, and they play with it.
There's all kinds of issues tied up in that. You could say astrology and feng shui is all we need. If you're in a low enough risk situation, it doesn't matter how your methods don't work.
Mm.
You can shrug and claim that they do work. This is why we get all these people saying this or that is a best practice. Best practices, none of these practices have ever actually been investigated in any sort of comparative sense where they say, oh, actually this practice really is better than the other one.
They often can't even be described in anthropological. Like, it's not defined in such a way that it could be repeated and you could conduct an experiment on it.
Right, and there's so much tacit stuff involved with that. That's one of the reasons why you can't lock it down. People don't even know what they're doing. I think what it's really at root is they go, well, I haven't been fired yet, so I guess whatever I'm doing is good. My company hasn't gone out of business yet, so I guess whatever I'm doing is good. But when people's companies do go out of business, they do get some patent bought by Google and then the rest of it just thrown away, you never hear them go, I guess none of those practices were good. They just shrug and go on to the next thing. So there's very little accountability or critical thinking there.
That reminds me of the Taleb story about the turkey. The farmer buys a turkey and feeds it every day. Every day the turkey is more and more comfortable around the farmer and sure of his place in life, and then eventually the day before Thanksgiving, he gets his head chopped off. The moral is don't be the turkey. Don't get too comfortable with what you're doing.
It also is that you can't use regression analysis to forecast the future. You can extrapolate in a nonlinear system and feel comfortable about that. So that's part of what's going on. None of us have a lot of evidence of a irrefutable kind and a comparable kind that crosses the boundaries of our various mindsets. So we're all kind of locked in our own world, and we just say, well, I haven't been punished for this yet, so I guess this must work by definition. The thing is that there's so many complicated factors involved in this. You mentioned the few test techniques. Well, those test techniques are actually rather shallow
ideas. Yeah, and they're old, and they're
very,
very ridiculous.
Shallow, simple ideas.
Fancy names.
You actually don't necessarily need those shallow ideas at all in order to do testing.
I never invoke a technique at a given period of time.
You never do? You never use a De Bruijn sequence to perform more efficient combinatorial testing in a sequence of events?
Maybe I do, but I'm not like, at this point in time, I'm going to use this specific technique.
I occasionally
pull
those out.
Well, if you knew what a De Bruijn sequence was, you might actually say, I'm going to use a De Bruijn sequence for that. But here's, I have to make your counter-argument for you since you're put off guard by the fact I just
I don't know what that is.
You don't know what that is. So I'll make your counter argument.
That's
you
just
can say,
pairs,
James,
right?
How many times have you used a DeBrayan sequence in anger in testing? And I would say twice in my entire career. But I think they're really cool, so I wanted to play with them. And so I found two excuses to use them. But yeah, I've used it twice.
Don't you say things like, I could use all pairs here, or you could say things like, I could use the decision tree here, where you say, well, just quick attacks the heck out of it, just to see if there's anything obvious?
Yeah, right. Okay, so I take my statement back.
Do you ever say, like, mind map? Let's put that in a mind map. Yeah, there's lots of little techniques, techniques that you use, you know, all the time. You fire up Google Docs and say, oh, no, I'll work with you on Google. That's a technique. Mm-hmm. You're working with somebody on Google Docs. And it's just so ubiquitous that we don't think of it as a technique. But take someone totally new to the industry, and they don't think of that because they've never done it before. They don't know what co-editing is. I've written an article with a guy, with Michael Bolton, where we're both writing in the same paragraph at the same time, in real time. I had never done that before. You know, just drafting, first draft stuff, and each of us are messing with the other guy, but trying not to mess too much with the other guy. And it was kind of fun. But it wouldn't have been fun if I didn't know him and trust him. I bet it wouldn't have been fun for him if he didn't know me and trust me. So it's not the technique. It's the technique plus the social context, plus all the relationships and the tacit knowledge
that makes it a lot
that
more
goes
powerful.
With it. So I think that when a lot of these collaborationists are saying, like, there's one guy I argued with. He said, what are your skills? Do you even think about skills? What is a skill of testing? He said, oh, skills. Yes, we have skills. Name one skill of testing. And he said, curiosity. Well, it's a very, very broad quality is what that act is. It's a broad behavior, you could say. Maybe you could say it's a skill, but it's incredibly broad.
Can you improve your curiosity?
How about this? Virtue. You know, we should have virtue.
Right.
Human fellowship. I mean, we can talk about all kinds of broad poetic qualities. But what I was thinking more of was, when I talked about skill, is I was thinking more of the skill of factoring. Factoring is the activity, and you have the skill of factoring, Justin. It's the activity where you decide which variables exist that you could work with. So when you discover what the piano keyboard is before you've played the music of testing, of course, part of how we discover the piano keyboard is we try the different notes and go, oh, that's a note that works. Oh, that one's broken, or that's not going to be helpful to us. So sometimes there's a lot of testing that goes along while you are discovering the variables that might matter. But I have a name for that. It's called factoring. When you don't have a name for it, you tend to just say it's testing or it's test design, and you just have these broad labels for things. And I've found that by making narrower labels, and I not only make the labels, but I encourage people to make up your own labels. I give them mine, but I don't say you have to use mine. That's how I avoid being just another bully, just another systematizer. I'm not saying you have to use my system. I'm saying that the process of thinking through and observing and labeling things is for each person part of building their own state of the art. And then, of course, there's a skill of comparing by saying, as you said earlier, Justin, maybe I do that, but not by that name. You know, I don't know that by that name, which is a wonderful thing to say because it keeps you from being intimidated by what someone says, like, I do glumping. Don't you do glumping? And if you say,
I don't know how to do that.
I don't know. I'm sure I don't do glumping. Then you sound like, yo, what's wrong with you? But if you say, I don't do anything by that name, but maybe I do the thing that you're talking about. Maybe I have a similar technique that I use. Why don't you describe what you mean? Show me, demonstrate, and I'll tell you what I call that. And that way, you're not knocked back. People aren't able to bully you or push you away or say, you're just not one of the people who know. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be a guy that pushes people and bullies people in that way. But I do want to be someone who deepens my art. That means I come up with lots of words, and I must give you permission to use different words in your own methods. But I do have a lot of words about techniques, a lot of words about skills. And that's how I sound like I know what I'm doing when I talk about skills. And when someone else says, curiosity? What that tells me is one of two things. Either they've never really thought about skills at all. They have no idea.
Not in a systemic way, right?
Right. Or they have thought about it, and they might even have developed it, but all of the development has been in the tacit realm, which means that the only way that I could find out how good they really are is by watching them. I'd have to be testing with them. And then I might discover, oh, wow, you're doing a lot of really interesting, sophisticated things. Well, I told you I was. I said I was a skilled tester. Well, you know, you said that, but then you told me a story that didn't sound like that.
You didn't provide the evidence.
But now that I'm seeing this, now I get it. You know, imagine this, just that we could close this. Imagine, thought experiment, you're an artist 40,000 years ago. You're talking to another artist, and you're critiquing each other's artwork that you've just made on this stone wall. You want to say to someone, you need some blue. But there's no word for blue. There's no concept. There's no word for color. There's no word for the plant that you use to make the blue in your thing. So you just want to say, more like this, less like that. Kind of like the sky with the thing up there. It would be really hard to talk specifically and critique art and develop your skills of art if you had no words for color, no words for the materials that you were using and all that. So the development of a language is as important as the development of the actual skills themselves. And I feel that the collaborationist side of the Agile community seems to have no particular interest in developing a better language of their craft. And I tell them this, and they just seem uninterested in that whole thing. So I just suspect that they don't really focus very much on excellence.
I mean, from a collaboration perspective, couldn't it be that, like, at the base of it all, we collaborate so that we can gain trust, and then from gaining trust, then we can focus on skills? Or maybe we're just...
Do you focus on skills? My question is, does that actually happen? Or do you spend all your time on this other thing and you never actually get around to the skill thing?
Gain from personal experience, where my teammates end up knowing that they can trust me with what I'm doing. That's when I can tell them, look, from what you're mentioning earlier, from the skills perspective, you know, instead of automating everything, let's apply a different coverage approach. Right? Let's apply a different...
Why would I trust you if I didn't think you knew what you were doing? So are you just being trust from a honesty standpoint, not a trust from an excellence standpoint?
It should be for both, shouldn't it be?
But you said, don't worry about skills until after we've done the trust. You've got to develop your skills.
Yeah, no. I didn't say that. I didn't say that. Like, so personally, I've developed my skills outside of the realm of collaborating with my team.
Okay.
But collaboration, in a sense, so that when I put in my input, like, they know that I'm in for the good of the team.
Oh, it's time. I got to go.
We got to go.
Sorry. That's a very good point, and I accept your point. We have to go teach the class now.
There you have it, folks. James Bach on reinventing testing skills, developing them, the importance of words.
Thanks. I got to teach the class now.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Testing Show, sponsored by Qualitest. For more information, please see www.qualitestgroup.com. Do you have questions? Or is there a topic or an idea you'd like to have covered? Please email us at thetestingshow@qualitestgroup.com, and we will answer questions we receive on air.